tonight's the last night. No class next week. We have a case for you. We'll hand it out at the end of class. Someplace here it is. We'll post it too in case you want to see it that way. But it's actually I think it's a very interesting case. The same thing. Unfortunately, we won't get to discuss it because it's an interesting, very interesting one. So tonight, what's the overall theme for tonight, besides the end of class? Was there something unifying? I was trying to think of these kind of like just different areas, but is there anything that pulls them together?
No. Talking about pulling the humanitarian and the landscape.
Yeah, well, the refugees, along with this outbreak of a disease, and I guess is there anything that is common to this?
Populations in distress.
Yeah, kind of in emergency situations. When is research appropriate in those circumstances?
Well, they say when it's directly, when it could be directly beneficial to the party involved, but there's just so many complicating factors with the instability of the environment that I just don't know how beneficial it would end up being.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's beneficial for them, but there's also this idea that you can learn from it. You can learn from the experience, what's happening.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the case that we'll talk about somewhat. But what did Pfizer argue in Trovan? Anybody want to take Pfizer's side in this? Okay, how about not taking their side? What did they argue? What did they assert?
I think they were trying to come up with something that was feasible as far as an oral medication that could really help in these third-world countries.
And they said they applied for a license to use it in outbreaks, meningitis, which really doesn't occur. I guess it occurs, but they're not on scale here in the developed world. So their argument is that it's primarily for the developing world. Of course, that didn't come with any commitment that I saw that would say we're going to actually provide this stuff.
I think these people are business-oriented, though they are hiding. They are business-oriented, though they are trying to hide themselves, like they are doing something like charity, helping. Because I know this is the big company, and they must have a lot of pharmacists and the medical personnel in the company. And they know how normally, they know the symptom and how the meningitis itself change rapidly and the fatal effect if it's not treated very effectively. So, normally, especially what I know for children, when it has been known that this is meningitis, it needs very aggressive measure which have to be treated very quickly. So these people are coming with oral medication which actually normally is not very fast. You see, it's not very fast acting drugs. No. What I know, normally what we do in our country, I know, if you know the kid had a child had meningitis, they use normally intravenous therapy to make sure that this bacteria being managed very fast so that they don't cause serious harm. So you look at these people, they go with oral medication. Actually, we know that for sure they knew, even in the US, that the children are supposed to be treated with intravenous therapy. But they go with oral medication, I think. I don't get an idea. Probably was a new product they wanted to look for the safety and effectiveness, they say. But their intention was not to treat meningitis.
Right.
And one of the questions I was asking myself, the child with meningitis usually is really very sick and cannot take anything orally. So I was asking how were they giving this medication and make sure that the child is getting the right amount of the dosage they needed to give, because they cannot really take anything orally until maybe if you can give with intravenous, NGT, the nasal tube.
Nasogastric.
I wasn't really sure what was happening. How could they give that drug?
Well, I was just going to say it was it was a big idea on their part, I think. I don't think they were really out to hurt anybody, but I don't think that they knew what they were doing from a development perspective. That's really sort of the bottom line. They didn't understand the patient population they were really dealing with. They didn't understand the pharmacokinetics of what they were dealing with. I think it was just bad, you know. Mm-hmm. There was a calamity of a million different types of errors here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all the tenet was that they were developing this for oral therapy, which would be useful in the country. I mean, oral therapy just isn't used for bacterial meningitis. And, whether the company or anybody else, at least the medical standard of care for.
Right. Don't get me wrong. That's what I'm saying. That you like this interaction here. I'm not arguing with you yet about that. I think what they had was this idea that it could work. Okay. Now, the issue was, how do you go about doing that or proving that? Okay. They went about it completely the wrong way. I mean, everything that they did here was wrong at every step along the way. It's possible to treat meningitis if you can get high enough blood levels and it crosses the blood-brain barrier. That's all possible. The issue was, they didn't even have the data to suggest that hypothesis was correct.
Yeah, actually, the alternative, which was to use chloramphenicol, which was the drug that the Doctors Without Borders, clinic used, which is very old, isn't used very often, and has a fair amount of toxicity, particularly in this setting in young infants. It turns out, actually, in the old days, if you couldn't get an IV into a young infant, because it was just impossible to get access, it turns out that oral chloramphenicol actually creates higher levels when it's given orally than it is when it's given intravenously, because of how it passes through the liver and gets converted. So the pharmacokinetics of chloramphenicol given orally is actually somewhat better, as long as you can absorb it. And the problem is that most of these kids, because they're otherwise ill, can't usually absorb it. So it's a desperation kind of measure. The principle is, it doesn't matter how the drug gets in your serum, as long as it gets there. But the standard medical practice, you have to start with the premise that you would give oral therapy unless you've proven that all those things are correct.
I just
curious,
how does the drug work?
MSF was there first, and they just kind of set up their clinic and started delivering care. And apparently the influx, there were hundreds of people per day were coming into this clinic. Apparently it's a real mess. And there was patient need. They just kind of, they must have gotten approval of the hospital from the sounds of it. I mean, they kind of came in, they were given the beds and the best parts of the clinic, and they really kind of pulled a quick one on MSF.
Well, I'm just thinking that's a sort of a way to talk about the state. It's sort of a way to cover certain mistakes that you might be making if you're not sure what you're doing. Is to sort of mix in with Doctors Without Borders.
I don't know if they were mixed in. I think they were two separate tents, literally.
They were two separate tents?
Yeah.
Part of the problem was that people coming to the clinic didn't know
which one to go in. Right.
They could have randomly kind of gone to either one.
Yeah, as the writer for the Washington Post said, their option was not to participating. The option was to walk across the compound to the other tent. That's, and you remember the video that we saw?
Yeah.
That was some advocates had made that video, but that which showed that hospital. It's just a mess.
I guess I just think they had more money. They could have been somewhere else. They didn't have to be right near the Doctors Without Borders.
So what was the right thing? What was the right approach? I mean, if it was more data on how this drug was worked in the pediatric population. I mean, it wasn't an approved drug, and in some ways, I think that's kind of fatal to this thing, is that they kind of just took this drug and put it in there. I guess they had some early data that it worked. I mean, they didn't have that early data that it worked. I think it would be really ludicrous because this is it's a pandemic. If it doesn't work, those kids are going to get sicker, and you could probably spread the disease as well. It seems to be even worse in some ways.
Typically what happens is that you do those kind of trials first in a setting where you have access to the central nervous system. So kids with shunts, VQ shunts or something, where you can actually sample spinal fluid.
Mm-hmm.
it's pretty, they have a shunt in already. So it's a way of knowing that you get antibiotics into their central nervous system. And it's also, and they also periodically will get infected. So in that setting where you're actually like tight control, and the other problem is that they didn't do any follow-up spinal fluid. So you don't know whether it's actually working or not, which was
fine. They also came out and said that they had in fact 6% mortality, which was really good. Their data collection and everything was like so spotty, and they didn't do long-term follow-up. I believe it.
Yeah, well, typically you're going to do a spinal tap, particularly if you don't know if it's active or not, pretty soon after the first one, in order to be able to show that you sterilize the spinal fluid.
And what bugged me is the IRBs here, you have to sort of show that you have the infrastructure to support studies, such as, especially if something is extreme. Mm-hmm. And they just seem to go in there knowing so well that everything was not available, everything's broken, everything is a mess.
Well, it sounds like they didn't even, from the comments that it said, they didn't even know what kind of facility it was. And that it was an urban, it was urban blight. And they were really surprised on many levels. I wonder if they learned their lesson. I mean, some of the things that they do in after the fact, they kind of cover up, it's just mind-boggling that anybody tries this stuff. And it's like, don't they have any, how do they sleep with themselves at night? There is an ethic about this. This is an ethical analysis. How are you going to sleep with yourself after you, when you do this?
Some of them
keep repeating the speech over and over, and it takes over. It really
and some of the reporting in the Post was a little factually inaccurate also. So, I mean, the fact is that there's a huge deal about giving an IM injection of ceftriaxone, which is the alternative drug. That's perfectly fine. I mean, it actually is the way it can often be administered. So, yeah.
But they didn't say IM. They said normally it's in the vein or a muscle, but they were giving it in the butt.
Yeah, but that's
they're
giving it IM.
That's the IM is intramuscular.
Is that an IM also? Mm-hmm. And what's the difference?
Intramuscular.
Yeah,
so what's the difference about so there was no difference at all in that?
No, I mean it's just the muscle.
Why'd somebody make a difference out of that?
I don't know. Because in fact, ceftriaxone was approved, it's commonly used to approve meningitis. Mm-hmm. Its advantage is that you can give it once a day or twice a day sometimes, and it and you can give it IM. So if you have a problem with the IV, you get almost equal levels intramuscularly, even in sick kids. But it's been used to treat meningitis that way. Although obviously, if you had a choice, you'd give it IV still. But there was this whole big deal about how horrible it was that they were getting IM injections of ceftriaxone.
Well, I think part of the issue the fact that they were getting IMs wasn't brought up by the advocates in that video. It was brought up that they were only getting 1/3 of the dose.
Yeah, that was not. That was not right.
Even according to Roche, that was a bit of a...
Right, afterwards. I think they got the first doses were okay, but then they decreased the doses because they didn't want to give as many injections.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, there is a certain code they say. Actually, I think it's, they might have taken from one of the five the record they say action taken, dose continued and changed the outcome death. See, so it's probably, is here, if you look at this, it's another mistake. But I know no matter if if they are really aimed to help these kids and they are trying their drug and they see it's not working, they could have changed to another, probably, other preparation or dose. But they are giving the same dose until the child dies. Mm-hmm.
But it really raises, I mean, what's the condition for the trial originally? Exactly. Were they in equipoise? Is this as good as? I mean, this was the first use in pediatric cases. It was used orally, and it was used in kids who were malnourished and really ill. And there's all kinds of reasons not to use those, be the first pediatric kid, people to be, to have the drug used on them. And got away with it. Well, they didn't get away with it, actually. So as we talked about last time, the Nigerian government did charge a bunch of people with criminal offenses, as well as civil offenses, and they got a $75 million payment. I think the first payments were actually made within the last couple of months. So some, I'm not sure how much those payments were. Are they going to the state? Are they going to the families? I think this, it's, the families got something out of it, but I'm not sure what.
Were some of these people charged Nigerians as well, or were they all?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Because this case, this brings into light the question, that whole tension between when do you work with the government and say, you know, you need help, we can provide help, so here's the help we're providing. Yeah, it's not the best kind of help, but this is what you're going to get. From, you know, whether Pfizer actually negotiated with the Nigerian government to drop themselves in there, whether there was anyone on the ground, given the catastrophe to a certain extent that was unfolding, whether there was any discussion, hey, we already have Doctors Without Borders, so there is help, like maybe you could help bolster that rather than come in, do research of this kind. It just brings into the question that issue, like, do you take a country's or health officials' justifications for bringing in or allowing outside researchers to come in at face value? Because A, they may not be in a position to make that decision. They might be under, you know, stresses themselves. They might be corrupt.
So, but what else would you do? I mean, if the state exists, and even if you know the state is corrupt, What are you supposed to do?
I mean,
you can't ignore them.
If I were decision makers at Pfizer, obviously I would exploit the situation because I'm evil, because I would think, oh, you know, there is something to be gained about it. What are you, the point of my question or my comment?
Do you think Pfizer would do it again if they had the opportunity?
Not the same way. Because if you don't learn from your mistakes, then you know, I don't think you get to be a company like Pfizer without learning from your mistakes.
Maybe.
My issue is, like,
I mean, it only cost them $75 million.
Can you not hold local officials accountable as well? Because at some level, this can't happen without full knowledge of people who are in the area. I say that full knowledge that maybe they're not in a position to really resist for various reasons.
Well, it's, for instance, I mean, the doctors, the people who were on the ground were being paid a lot of money, right? And the one nurse was like paid double. We've heard about that in other situations where kind of the helicopter researchers fly in and they kind of like pay big salaries. They suck up resources and they suck it away from other activities.
Almost undue influence of a very different kind of, not just the
Well, that's on the ground. I mean, the other problem is that if the government is corrupt itself, and what do you do? I mean, we've talked about, you know, is the government, are people capable of protecting themselves? And part of that is looking at the government that's in place, and I mean, it's the structure of your, not only the structure, but even the individuals, and who are they, and how corrupt are they?
What do you do, as you said, you rather than make a generalized sort of stereotype about people, actually figure out if there are one or two non-corrupt people there, work with other NGOs.
And who does that, though? So, I mean, who's charging?
There must be a happy medium between.
Well, I'm not asking. I'm not challenging you. Yeah. I'm not basically trying to say, you know, if you're the researcher, if you're a researcher and you're not, you're Pfizer or not. I mean, you're actually trying to understand this and plan for it. I mean, you can talk to the NGO, mm-hmm. to NGOs on the ground.
The area.
And the MSF arguably had somebody, although they may be helicoptering in as well. They may helicopter in and pay kind of like local doctors and providers to work with them. So when Pfizer shows up, of course, they're going to suck off the resources that MSF was always trying to use. But it's really, I mean, you know, the funny thing is that we kind of rely on IRBs to protect and raise these questions, but this is like such detailed knowledge. I mean, IRBs are would be totally incapacitated to do this. It's like, do you have local IRB review? Sure, here's a letter. And that's the end of it. And what more could we ask of an IRB? But the researchers, I mean, in some sense, the researchers are almost driven by the desire to do good research, because this clearly wasn't. But then also to kind of like work with local officials and NGOs and others on the ground to kind of make the research as ethical as possible. And if there's no commitment of the researchers to do that, you can't look. I don't think you can look to others to do it. I'm just making the argument. I mean, nobody else is going to step up. And so it's not the research. I mean, ultimately, you know, when we talk about ethics, I mean, a lot of people kind of shy away from the fact that researchers are ultimately are responsible for their research. And they are. I mean, they can, even here, if they're doing studies, they can kind of pull all kinds of shenanigans. But when you're dealing with states that are in disrepair or worse, then they have not necessarily carte blanche, obviously, as they didn't get away with this in this case, but they have a lot of discretion. They can pull a lot of stuff. They can buy people off. They can buy things off. They can just
why we should have a higher obligation under those situations. And at some level, you might say, well, it's unfair to hold the researcher up to the standard. But on the other hand, you could say the researcher is one of the biggest stakeholders in the situation, because at some level.
But what does that mean? I mean, Pfizer gets their hands slapped to the tune of $75 million. I mean, actually, if you think about corporate punishment as a general rule, even in the United States, it's money. You know, very rarely do we in law, you know, for the lawyers in the course, you know, that's very rarely do we pierce the court, what's called piercing the corporate veil, and reach in with corporate, with punitive sanctions and reach the individuals who didn't violate the law. Instead, we punish the corporation, or in this case, Pfizer. One of the big sticking points in this is Pfizer wanted basically an agreement by the Nigerian government that they didn't do anything wrong. And that's fairly typical. But the thing is that you need to be able to breach, and it's something. I mean, it's known in corporate sanctions in this country. You know, so you pay your, you know, like, you know, people, but, you know, like, what, corporations violate laws all the time, and, you know, environmental laws and other kinds of regulations. And they get their hands slapped. They pay millions of dollars in fines, and everybody walks, and they continue the same stuff. And sometimes it's extremely profitable for them to do.
But it's different in the securities law context. I mean, obviously there have been some individuals who have been held liable. In the securities law,
sure.
Fraud context, it's just that in the pharma context, I guess it hasn't come to that yet.
Yeah. And in the environment, I mean, there's lots of areas where, you know, corporations pay fines. You know, I mean, the biggest one in pharma, of course, is, you know, for kind of like the price controls, pricing games that people pay. And they just kind of gouge the public, and they get caught, and they pay pay a very small percentage of the profits that they've collected over the years, and they go on their happy ways. And yeah,
a couple comments on what you said, John. So the first one is, I don't think it's just money. I think the reputation of Pfizer, the reputation hit that Pfizer took on this, you know, I think it's just immeasurable.
So where does that play out?
It plays out at every level, and, you know, in many different, people will not collaborate with them, people will not trust them, people may or may not buy their drugs because of it, people, you know, downstream people may not want to, you know, sort of work with them scientifically because they look at this and say, this is the type of stuff that you guys do, I don't want to have any part of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you know of any?
And that hurts, absolutely.
Really?
That's exactly, this is what the whole conflict of interest issue is about. You know, there's pharma does bad science, we in the university, we do good science. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the problem.
Yeah, but that's not, I don't think that's the rule, but that's not the take-home message, though. Pharma generally, as a general rule, does really, really good science. Mm-hmm. And the evidence to supports that.
I completely agree. Mm-hmm. I agree with that premise. I'm not saying that that's right. I'm saying that sort of the hit that, you know, that pharma research institutes take because of things like this is immeasurable, and Pfizer has suffered the consequences because of it. And from my perspective, I don't know, Ed, if you have a take on this, but I would suspect something like happened because they didn't have the appropriate scientific controls in place, you know, within their research organization. You know, I don't know the details behind the story here, but I suspect this may have been sort of a junior level person that had a big idea that the commercial people said, oh yeah, sure, we'll go for that. You know, we'll sort of help support that at the senior levels when people were deciding how to, you know, how to dole out the research bucks.
Didn't it say the product manager for Trovan was involved in this?
Well, exactly, could have been. It wasn't.
Yeah, that's fairly.
I'm saying there wasn't the appropriate scientific control in the organization to say that this is a bad idea, or if this is a reasonable idea, you're not doing it the right way. Let's do it this way. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's approach it this way. What do you think?
I think the way, when things happen badly in those organizations, it often is because of this imbalance of responsibility. It's less often happens in the earlier research time. It happens during these times when this blockbuster drug is going to be developed, and the commercial environment for the development of the drug and the promises about what the drug is going to deliver, just like any other you could consider it a financial conflict, but it's really a sort of just, this is a big drug, it means a lot to the organization. Those things drive a lot of people's thinking, and so
I'm sure
somebody was sitting around and saying, oh, by the way, this is a great opportunity. There's a bunch of, it's a philanthropic kind of opportunity, and the drug would be available to folks who wouldn't have it. We're going to put docs on the ground, and it's an easy way, in a sense to get data about pediatrics, and we want that included in the label when the drug gets approved. The problem is that when that imbalance happens, the medical voice, no, I don't know, the medical voice could have been incompetent in this case also, but assuming that there was a competent medical voice, I don't know whether it's a problem of them not knowing, which sometimes happens because people are not experts in the space that they're actually working in, if they're higher in the organization, or if it's more that it wasn't listened to, other factors sort of dominated, and then things happen as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes it's, I mean, it's also, I mean, I think within the organizations, I mean, nobody wants, at a particular point, nobody wants the drug to go belly up on their watch.
Right.
I think this happened with Merck. I mean, there was what I perceive as a cover-up. That, I mean, you know, basically it was a cover-up, a publication of the data, but no analysis of the data on cardiac outcomes in the Merck pain
killer.
Vioxx. And you know, it's like somebody, so they've been through trials and they got all these big studies, they've invested hundreds of millions of dollars, wants it to go belly up then. And Trovan was perhaps the same kind of thing. But maybe not. I mean,
the other thing that happens is that prospective assessment of what's going on is a lot more complicated than retrospectively looking at what actually, you know, the outcome is in retrospect. So
right.
I don't think those circumstances for both of these cases are not justified in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But making a decision when you're sort of looking in a sea of data about two people who have something, you know, when do you really begin to know that something's going on, as opposed to when do you, because stuff happens in research all the time, and it's totally unrelated to the things that you're trying to do. So it doesn't justify any of them, certainly these cases, egregious cases of you know, what happens. But it's complicated. That if you give them, give the other side the benefit of the doubt, then, you know, they're wrapped up in their, and it's no different, I don't think, than getting wrapped up in scientific advancements. You know, I mean, Tuskegee was not about money, it was about getting scientific knowledge at whatever cost it took to keep pushing that story.
The imperative.
Yeah, it's not like it doesn't happen every, it happens in all the settings, especially when these things get out of balance and there's no check on people's enthusiasm or unbridled enthusiasm.
But, you know, I don't think you can compare it to Tuskegee, because there's this pharmaceutical company that had potentially going to make all this money, or is theorized that they're going to make all this money if this medication works. So I am a little bit more of a cynic thinking about kind of what Pfizer's role was in this. So I don't generally give them as much leeway.
No, see, so I'll disagree with you, because I think that, you know, from as what John was, I won't disagree that there wasn't an economic incentive. That's not the issue. The issue is what the incentive is for, you know, the investigators, for example, that were doing things years ago, like with Tuskegee, about the science, the profession, in the profession, professional advancement, that those sorts of things. And they didn't see anything that they, from their perspective, not doing anything wrong, and they wanted to make their name and reputation. So it's a different type of conflict. It's a different type of interest, but a conflict of interest, no less.
Right. I agree that it can be a conflict of interest. I also agree that there's in both cases, there's strong disrespect for the subjects of the research.
Yeah. Correct.
Exactly.
Totally disregarded them.
Right.
Which is the point where I would want to find out if the BIs in both those situations knew or felt at some level that they were doing something.
Right.
Yeah, well, some of those, I mean, the Guatemala stuff, there's sort of evidence they probably knew and may have covered up some of those things, so.
But there is, I mean, Guatemala, it was interesting because we talked about the Guatemala aspect of it. I mean, it was wrapped up early, right? It was wrapped up. There's something wrong here. I mean, unlike Tuskegee, they kind of realized that we're kind of like doing something that made it like pass the New York Times sniff test or something.
I think the situation got out of control and the stakes were so high at that point that there was almost like no turning back until something happened that forced them to
I also think they. It sounds to me like they get a little paternalistic, and they're like, well, we're helping these poor people, so, you know.
Which also speaks to that bias. I mean, they believe,
right.
I mean, that's one of the problems. If somebody works on a drug, they get this belief
that
it works, and they kind of
overlook. I think culturally, too, you know, they're like, oh, these poor people, they don't have access to anything, we're helping them.
Meanwhile, MSF is right 20 yards away.
Right, exactly.
Using a different, an old drug regime that's dangerous.
Right.
But they're actually using something they have no idea
right.
how dangerous it is or how it would work.
And then there's the whole standard of care issue. I mean, are you in a situation where your life mortality is low anyway, and this is going to give you some additional hope? Again, I'm not saying I buy that argument, but I can see it's reasonable for people to believe that that's the case. I mean, we're not talking about healthy children in a developed country here.
So is it a placebo? It's placebo controlled? It was active controlled. It was active controlled. Right. Although they game the active.
Right.
Do they ever use? Would they ever use antibiotics, especially of different classes, in combination therapies? So would they ever add? Could they have added this?
Yeah. Although they won't. I mean, they usually put the antibiotics together because you're not sure what the etiology is. So they never talk about what meningitis this was. Presumably, it's pneumococcal or meningococcal meningitis or something. But, You don't usually, for the common varieties of bacterial meningitis, you usually just need a drug. Unless in the beginning you don't know what it's caused by, in which case you're covering a bunch of things.
Mm-hmm.
In case.
Yeah, but since they don't see that, I guess the thing is that if they were giving the standard of care, they know it's not going to hit every case. So with a chemotherapy, could they have done an added design?
You can. It's just a little more complicated scientifically.
To see the signal,
that you'd have to know. You know, you'd have to have provisions to exactly know what the etiology is, and then you can change the antibiotics entry, and then you have another non-inferiority design. And it is possible, but it's a little bit more.
They need a lot larger sample size.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, all of them, I mean, ceftriaxone, when it was first introduced, nobody knew whether, I mean, it was the same sort of concept, but a lot of work, I mean, you knew how that it got into spinal fluid,
right.
You knew that there were animal models of spinal fluid, you knew that it covered the bacteria pretty well.
Sure.
Before, you did these studies
exactly.
With kids with shunts and all that sort of stuff, so,
right.
Yeah, it was an experiment, but it's also a microbiology experiment
right.
Where most of it is about killing the bug.
The probability of success was pretty high.
It's high, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if they ever published these findings. I bet not. Because, I mean, so the only data that we have is kind of like reports and kind of like PR people getting up and talking and stuff like that. I did say that they did say that the drug worked, but it didn't say that it worked better than the alternative.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see anybody say that.
Yeah, they said it was equally effective and safe
right.
Was their conclusion, but that was based on.
Right. Which... The funny thing is that, I mean, even if you're an equipoise, to do this kind of trial under the circumstances, it seems to be bad. Anyway.
Did you do this kind of trial in this particular kind of way under these circumstances? Because you could imagine, like, they'd spend more money and, you know, do the 3 or 4 spinal, or whatever is needed.
Sure.
But is it okay in this? I mean, that's the question. I mean, for maybe if this drug was not at this point in its development, but there was a lot more data on its efficacy and its side effects and all.
And there was a real IRB rather than a made-up one.
Well, would that have mattered?
not given what transpired, but it seems like this whole this case to me also calls into question the two twin principles of having the IRB and having informed consent that's in the common rule. Because that really doesn't, that those two twin principles, meaningful informed consent and having the IRB review, that doesn't really work under many circumstances.
Right.
They're almost not the relevant issues at hand that you need to look at to make that ethics decision.
Right.
And also, if they have that much money, they should have brought their own resources there and not get there and then discover they don't have the resources, so they can't do the study properly.
Mm-hmm.
That is just so wrong.
Okay, bad Pfizer. So I'm surprised that I'd be interested in knowing what Pfizer, if they paid a price for this. Because the funny thing is, I have some anecdotal evidence. I mean, it was interesting because you said people wouldn't buy their drugs and stuff like that. Yeah, I don't know about that. But even in the developing world, I met an advocate from Indonesia a couple years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, and he said that people in Indonesia will, you know, there's middle income and kind of like some part of the population in most countries of the world that have money and can afford kind of name brands. And Pfizer, of course, like everybody else, does market in those countries. In fact, they usually price their drugs in those markets so they can, like, extract. You know, they'll capture the people who can afford their drugs, and they basically maximize their rents from those people. And he said there are people who will kind of go without other things in order to buy the brand drug because of the likelihood of, not what do they call them, false fake drugs? What's that called? Anybody know?
Well, yeah, but that's the issue of the generic drugs.
Well, it's not only generics, it's actually fake counterfeits. So the counterfeit in those countries is a really big problem. So people, just to make sure that they're getting the best, you know, they're really sick, and they'll actually kind of like save up their pennies and buy the Pfizer drug. And Pfizer was actually used by this guy as the example in that case. And this was many years after this case. So it's like, well, how did this play out in the press, and how did it play out? I mean, are people still willing to participate in clinical trials run by Pfizer and all? I mean, it's interesting, because some years ago, Jason Garlowitz here did a study asking people why they participate and all, and what are the determinants of why they participate. And one of the things he found was that Merck at the time, this is pre-Vioxx, but Merck had this great reputation. People were like, oh, it's Merck. You know, they're not going to hurt me, and it's, you know, kind of like supporting Merck, and maybe because it's a local company or something like that, I don't know. But and I always wondered if he'd get the same reaction post-Vioxx. I mean, did the company take a reputational hit because of that drug? And I think that's even more direct. I mean, that was a big thing here in the States. Whereas this Trovan case, yeah, if you're in the kind of you're in the know, Trovan is a big thing. Maybe if you're in the developing world, maybe it became an issue. It's like, you know like the Constant Gardener kind of thing, that these companies are coming down here and doing crazy things to us. But you know, how is that disseminated, and does it really play out? If somebody's asking you to be in a trial and you're saying, oh, it's Pfizer. Anyway, I don't know. I've never heard of any evidence of that, so it'd be interesting to.
Nobody's probably tested it in the appropriate way.
No, that's true. But it's not even clear how you would do it. But it would be interesting to see. And I imagine if anybody knows, Pfizer knows. Which, if it was true, why did it take them 10 years to settle? 14 or 15 years to settle? Why didn't they say, we need to make this go away? You know, just.
You probably didn't want to set a precedent.
Ooh. Should have been thinking that wasn't that when they did the study.
They probably thought they could get away with it, really.
Hindsight is 2020.
No, they tried. Yeah. Well, they also, I mean, the lawyers really tried. Right? The lawyers put up a really good defense. They also actually almost won at various stages. I mean, if you remember, I talked about this last time, but they basically said that there was the case should be heard in Nigeria. So the district court really dismissed the case, basically saying take it to Nigeria, and that was appealed. And the Second Circuit of Court of Appeals basically said no, it's going to be heard here in New York. So then it came back, and that's one of the reasons it got dragged out for so long. And of course, by that time, the Nigerian government had gotten involved. They had a report. That report was done, and they brought charges themselves in Nigeria against the officials, which I guess doesn't have much ramification, except that if the CEO ever wants to go and travel to Nigeria.
But I think also the government at that time, because by the time the study took place, they were being led by Sanabacha, who was a dictator actually. I think it was in his president that this research was approved to go on, I think. There was nobody who could criticize his argument unless you want to go into trouble. So I think they had to wait. It was fortunate enough that this guy died, I guess. Mm-hmm. Then another person came into power. I think had a little bit they had a democracy that somebody can talk there, this and this, switch up, and then taking also investigation take place. Also. Mm-hmm. But other thing, what I think that if you go that this study, probably it might be known in Nigeria and some parts, very few parts of Africa. Mm-hmm. But I think this big company, when they do mistake, they try to cover most of media to make sure that this thing are not known globally. Mm-hmm. Because if you go in Tanzania, you say that this thing which happened in Nigeria, for example, unless intellectuals will know that, but many people won't know.
Do you think it ever made the press in Tanzania? Mm-hmm.
Because most of international news we get, like CNN and other big broadcast, BBC, we didn't hear about this issue.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So the other question I think you raised it was, you know, who was punished? Because the local PI in this study, it's like, yeah, well, I guess we could have done more for that girl, patient 69 or whatever, and. You know, it's just like, and yeah, we kind of like lied about the getting backdating the ethics review thing, and yeah, we did this and we did that, and it's like, and then he goes and gives 2 days of testimony to the government panel. And it's like, did they bring charges against him? Or was this really, I mean, it suggests they've not, that it's really political, and they're just kind of reaching for the deep pockets of Pfizer.
Actually, that's the one of the issue I was thinking, why did that local investigator was not punished together with the company? I don't know. Probably that's, he found himself like the way of escaping that, to say that they forged the letter, there was no this and this, the way to escape. But actually, it is a very complex situation. I don't know. Why did they leave him? Or probably he was coerced by the government. We don't know. Mm-hmm. To be involved, then probably that might be his excuse. Mm-hmm. We don't know. But why himself and not the other doctors who say that we knew this, it was the wrong things, but we could not say.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, we kicked this case around. We kicked Pfizer around enough. Thanks. All right. What else is here? So what about the ethics of in refugee populations? Any comments about this? Any thoughts, any reactions to the paper? We had a proposal, I know there was a protocol here. You guys in the IRB might be able to speak to this. I don't know if you reviewed it, but I remember somebody was proposing to go to Darfur and go to the refugee camps and interview people and about their experiences and how they got there and what access to resources they have and stuff like that. And what do you think if that proposal came up to do that? What do you think of it?
Well, I think also when you want to go to the refugee, you have to, like, if you want to go to Darfur, is it the time of the war or is it after war? Because if you go at the time of war yourself, you won't be safe, and I don't know how you can do that. And one of the things is, how can you study those people, because they are very scattered. You might find the mother is here, the child is there. You might find a group of people you cannot even discuss with them, and the language maybe is a problem, because we have some experience with the refugees from Congo and Rwanda. Mm-hmm. Of course, they give them the camps and they stay there. Mm-hmm. One of the issues was, if you are posted to work with them, you don't understand their language and they don't understand you. Mm-hmm. And you find some of the children are just alone. No one is there. And most of them are really hurt deeply, because I think they have seen some of the people being killed in front of them, and it's really difficult even to discuss with them psychologically, and they are really not in good shape.
Mm-hmm. So that's just from a caregiving perspective, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you are going to do the research, I don't know, it's difficult, but maybe you can try and do it. Because they also have some problems with diseases, the outbreaks.
Cholera
is one of them, and skin infections, STIs, they're very common problems in there. But the problem is, how are you going to do it?
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about who would be an advocate for the group, because usually refugees come into, you know, other countries at their mercy at some level. So someone's being, you know, beneficent in some particular kind of way, but there's really no one speaks for them. So these are interesting guidelines. The proposed guidelines are good. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with these guidelines. But who will be in charge of ensuring that the guidelines are adhered to? The government where you find the refugee population, their interests aren't necessarily aligned with that, because they might sort of complain about certain conditions.
That's true.
You know what my question with the refugees, I find it very difficult, especially when you look at the issue of autonomy and making consent. Even when you may make this, for these guidelines, the right of somebody to refuse, that is in question, because most of them are vulnerable and they need anything to be helped. So probably somebody might think that if I refuse, even if they see that this is very risky for me, but if I refuse, probably I won't get some sort of benefits. So actually researches in the refugee camp is a challenge, because you don't know if people agreed, because they understood what they wanted. It was they excited their autonomy, or it's like they are coerced because of the situation.
Sure. It's interesting because they do talk about heads of household and getting culturally appropriate approval from heads of households and community leaders, but I guess it would be really, really, really difficult to find those, figure out who's who.
Sometimes they don't have head of families because the family is just too distorted. One of them is in one place and the other one is in another place, and maybe it will take time before they come together, and sometimes they even don't come together. Some of them are lost completely and they are not really sure where they are.
Actually, they normally select leaders among themselves. If you can know those leaders, they probably.
Makes sense. So the issue about concern for the safety of the researcher, this comes up once in a while when people kind of like propose various crazy things. This would be one of them. And the question then is always, well, is that really the IRB's purview?
I don't think so. They're not subjects, right. So.
Unless they're doing it to themselves.
Yeah.
Just taking their own blood. But so who really monitors that? Remember, we had a discussion on the IRB forum. So the IRB forum is a discussion list for IRB issues that I moderate. And somebody raised this protocol where somebody was going to go off and they wanted to see people's reactions when they were approached on the street and hit on by somebody of the same gender. So they had like research assistants who were going to go out, and graduate students who were going to go up and just kind of like solicit sex from somebody of their same gender. I was like, okay. And I don't think they went proving it, because you could get decked, and it wasn't really concerned for the psychological injury to the subjects, but it was really concerned about the researchers. And it's like, and if that's not inside the IRB's purview, who's going to keep a check on that? And the IRB had a real hard, because the IRB was like, no, we can't do this. No. But it wasn't clear that they're allowed to do that, because it's not subjects.
It was because of the threat of harm, or because they found the subject matter too troubling?
Well, it was probably pretty stupid graduate student study or something. But at the end, I don't know. But I mean, that would have been justified. You know, it's like we don't really care how people are going to react on the street. It's not important. Not an important question. And no, your research, your graduate students shouldn't be put at risk of physical harm to do this. But in this case, it's like, you know, sending somebody there. It's like, well, what does the IRB ask? It's like, man, what can they do?
I don't know. I think that's a little different if it's the investigator themselves going over versus putting a bunch of, like, college kids at risk. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, if it's a PI, it kind of goes to autonomy. I don't know. I don't see. It hasn't come up since I've been at the IRB, but I don't know that that's really the IRB's concern.
And there's other grounds. I mean, you could basically, as the IRB, or a funding agency, you could basically say, well, what experience does this PI have
right.
with this group, and have
right.
you been there before,
and
do you speak the languages, and kind
stuff.
Of like do other things to make sure that the research could be carried out safely for everybody.
Because otherwise it's an inefficient use of resources, you get
right.
stuck there, and
then you're a whole institution. But you could say that the research question would be important and it should be done, but it's going to be done the right way.
And investigators have to get approval from department heads before it even comes to the IRB, so I don't know if the onus is on them, if there's certain departmental or rules at Penn that govern that, I'm not sure. But
chair might not like you. Sure, go.
Yeah, exactly, so I'm not sure if that's
Zeke,
the level.
Zeke, in fact, asked me to go to the
IRB. At Penn, if you got 10 department chairs to go to 10 of them, would have
done.
Yeah.
Anyway, any other comments about this?
Are you aware of research and refugee populations that have gone through and have been proven to be successful?
No, I don't know of any. I mean, that one study was, I don't think it took place, because it was just kind of like, it was not really well thought through, I don't think. But it would be pretty easy to figure out, actually. I mean, we could find, who's got Google? But it'd be, you know, it's been a problem for some years, so it'd be interesting. And the interesting thing is that, you know, like the policy paper here I don't know if they were talking about some other papers. They do refer to some other papers, and maybe they reviewed actually extant studies, which would be kind of an interesting thing to do. It's like, well, what research does take place in the camps? And are the questions, do they satisfy these kinds of criteria?
Well, I don't know if this is true. Probably the number of internally displaced people and refugees has probably grown pretty exponentially in recent years. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's probably not something that was coming up a lot in the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably coming up a lot now.
Sure. And it'd be interesting because there are important questions and policy questions that turn on you. How do you respond to this? How does the state respond to this? How does the public, the international community, the NGO community kind of respond to these needs? But, all right. And the last paper, another social justice paper. Yeah. I have a bad attitude about papers like this. Anybody want to discuss this one?
Materials and supplies and people who are not privileged, you not have that much access. But at the same time, you also have to train people who usually have access to do with less so that everybody can, because there's hoarding during pandemics. So you want to make sure that if you're going to get involved in any kind of a pandemic response or preparation for it, you want to make sure that you can distribute the access equally and make sure that people who
What do you mean by equally?
Well, okay, like, say for instance, I went to a FEMSI conference one time.
What?
A FEMSI conference, academic preparedness, pandemic preparedness here in Philadelphia. And they were talking about how to increase access to the local communities. They were talking about using the Postal Service to supply drugs. They were talking about these little pods that they set up in different neighborhoods to make sure that everybody can have access, using the pharmacy, using the pharmaceutical companies as disposing units, you know. But one of the problems, I think, was just not just dealing with making sure that people who were poor had access, but also making sure other people did not hoard who were used to having access to everything. So that was the... That's the part I meant by equality.
But isn't that part of their point that there is an unequal access here, and we should basically kind of like plan to kind of help those who don't normally have access?
Right. Yeah.
So that's not equal. In some sense, it's not equal. In fact, they actually do say for people who have the means, they can get it themselves. Which actually raises the question: well, what is the purpose of the program? If it's a government program, what is the purpose? Is it kind of a social justice, or is it equal access? I mean, in some ways, the structural kind of thinking, the structural equality is like, as long as we set up the systems, everybody has equal access. They show up, and they get it, and they walk it. And rich or poor is treated the same by the state.
Well, at this meeting, there was lots of agencies there, people from the government, local, national, and the local. They wanted to include more local agencies, like the fire department, the police, you know, to get an idea of on the ground what it was like, what it would be like during, you know, emergency to get access to people in the rural communities and try to, like, set up things like if people had block clubs, you know, block captains, maybe using those individuals as resources. So, but they did bring up resiliency a lot, you know, and building that resilience for everyone, not just people who did not normally have access, but those who usually do, because they would have to do less. Mm-hmm. And that's a challenge.
Sure.
But resiliency, you mean like teaching people proactively that you shouldn't be a hoarder? Yeah. I would like to see that world. But I'm not sure that happened without security posted in each of those spots that ensured that one person got one and not ten.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately.
I should meet some Big Brothers watching.
So any other thoughts about this one? is kind of, I don't want to say it's attractive, it's just, I think it's different views of the world, in a way. But it also, I mean, I would actually relate back to what I said earlier. So, you know, it's like, what is the purpose of the government program? Is it maybe to provide access to people who wouldn't otherwise have access? Or is it to provide universal access? Because it's a public health emergency, and we're going to address that need. If it's that need, then isn't the goal maximal? Or what is the goal? Is it maximum? I mean, the interesting thing is they don't talk about economics here or at all. But if you think, well, is it maximal body count at the end? We want minimal body count at the end. You want to maximize your preservation of public health. It might give you a different answer if you take the social justice approach, arguably. The people, they're basically saying you should target people who are most likely to succumb to give them the best shot at survival, which necessarily means then that you're willing to, what? I think it necessarily means that your overall survival is going to drop. Everybody understand that one?
No. Why would your overall survival drop if you're choosing the sickest people?
Yeah, you're treating the sickest people, so...
They're less likely to recover,
people who are
right?
Most likely to get infected.
Maybe not.
Whatever.
Yeah, maybe you're right. So it depends on your survival rate. I mean, it depends if it works, I guess.
Yeah.
If people who would normally succumb, you're going to get them to survive, and then you're going to drop survival in the populations that would normally survive.
They have a higher chance of survival if they're...
Yeah. So you could, I guess, yeah, it could actually work out overall and better. No?
I sort of take a paper like this and say, okay, I don't really agree with everything in here, but it raises interesting questions. Like, can you apply this thought process to other areas? For example, if there is a pandemic of some sort and you need to get the message out, and you sort of assume that you use a form of getting the message out that only the middle class and upper middle class can use, let's say, internet, and not everyone has it. Text people's cell phones, maybe that would be, maybe cell phones are more widely used, or text are more widely read. So using methods of delivery that don't bias, that don't have an inbuilt bias about a particular kind of population.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's what the paper is really saying, but mm-hmm. Every paper is like this, and that's what it reminds me of. But you have to remind yourself that we have structural inequities, and when you're designing a system, if your goal is more or less noble, then you need to take that into account.
Hmm. So I just talked, I guess I talked to myself out of what my earlier argument was. Especially if the people who are normally going to survive have access anyway. Right? Because they do say, kind of like, you know, the rich can take care of themselves, which can lead to hoarding, of course. Especially if they know about that policy beforehand.
But you don't know that.
Because there are economists who made the argument that the poor are actually extremely resourceful because they have to live with much less than most people. So they actually end up becoming more resourceful. There's data that shows that in developing countries, the poor are more resourceful than people who have, you know, used to so much. They're not particularly resourceful in their day-to-day lives. So when all hell breaks loose, they're not also going to be the most resourceful ones.
But is resourceful the same as resilient?
Sometimes,
I think so.
Not always. Resiliency depends on your life experiences. That has nothing to do with economic circumstances necessarily.
And there's a lot of biology. I mean, the fact is that it's not, I mean, it's true that poverty is associated with increased risk from a lot of these things.
Right.
But if a pandemic of H5 or H9 or H1 happened, and it was a real pandemic, then the people at risk are actually in demographics that are not all defined by economic status. So children and pregnant women were the highest risk populations in the H1N1 disasters.
Mm-hmm.
So
the elderly usually.
The elderly are, but it turns out that if you introduce a new flu virus into the community, the people that are older have risk because they have comorbidities, but they also have prior experience. They probably have prior experience, and they live within the right age group. But a newborn in that setting has essentially no no prior experience. And so those kids are actually better off in seasonal flu, depending on what their age is. But for pandemic virus, it's actually the people who, you know, in seasonal flu, if you're an average healthy person, you still have a mortality risk, but your mortality risk is considerably less than the other ends of the spectrum. When you introduce a new virus, then it's the younger, healthier folks and the younger kids who actually die in greater numbers than the other folks. And so that's what happened in the great pandemic.
1918.
Oh.
Interesting.
I thought the paper was interesting in that it raises your awareness of the fact that obviously people have to be paying attention to those things when they do it, but it's not as simple as simply saying we should just give it all to the poor communities.
Right. I also think it's not as simple as saying it's purely scientific, because there are some economic, I think there is an economic overlay or a social overlay, because unless it's one of those situations where all hell is breaking loose, it's a middle phased in situation, it is more likely that people with more resources, with more access to better hospitals, will probably get, even if the pregnant children and the and pregnant women, children, and the elderly, that they're likely to get seen first at some level.
Yeah, I'm just saying that it's not, it's multifactorial, and it's sort of who's at risk.
But I would overlay that with it all, will also depend on what your, before all that pandemic, well, the pandemic started, what were the rules of engagement in that particular community. It's a pretty well-integrated kind of community where, people take care of each other to a certain extent. They're probably not going to change overnight just because a pandemic is happening. So.
The other thing that happens is that risk-based interventions are notoriously poor compared to broad-based, simple to implement interventions. So, you know, the whole flu recommendation story for many, many years was just totally screwed up. And it was because of supply, not because of the, so the supply was triaged to the people that were at highest risk. And in fact, what happened is that the overall population was very poorly immunized, including healthcare workers and everybody else. I mean, it took decades before, which is now true, which is the recommendation is just to universally vaccinate everybody, which is much simpler to implement, has much bigger impact, but it was really driven by the supply of vaccine and not, and the need to do this kind of triage and prioritization, as opposed to a blanket request, which is much easier to implement. You can use all kinds of mechanisms to give people, you know, to get people the vaccine.
So how did we cure the shortage problem?
It's a long story, but it literally is a chicken and egg story. I mean, fluency is made in chicken and eggs. But the problem was there was always this debate. I mean, flu vaccine was a commodity. I mean, it costs pennies, and it costs pennies to make, and the companies that make it make very little from, I mean, they make generally, the government purchasing for flu vaccine is literally a few cents, so, you know, maybe 50 cents or something to vaccine. The problem was that because there was not a market, there wasn't great incentive to, you know, to create more vaccines. So if you have a vaccine manufacturing plant and we're making vaccines for other things, flu was one of the things that was made routinely. It's impossible to, changes every year, has to be, it's a huge investment of time. But because it was a commodity, it didn't make very much money. And because it didn't make very much money, nothing was invested in the infrastructure. And so the infrastructure started to fall apart. And frankly, part of the worry about pandemic flu and, in a sense, biodefense made a big difference. I mean, people started to say, well, first of all, for pandemic flu, there's a market, at least, for those particular viruses because the government's going to buy them. And then there was some introduction of some new vaccines, and that sort of raised the price a little bit. There was an interest in changing the vaccine from egg-based to cell-based production. And all that stuff resulted in ultimately people building manufacturing plants that created enough. And then the CDC was moving in the direction of universal vaccination, which created a bigger market too. So at the end of the day, there has been, you know, every time somebody gets worried about a pandemic, lots of vaccine is made. Often that vaccine is actually not, most of it is actually gotten rid of because people don't get vaccinated. Anyway,
did the government ever kind of like directly invest in like the, you know, GSK's or Wyeth's kind of like vaccine capacity? I mean, did we ever?
Yeah.
do it so directly?
Aren't the DOD are investing in vaccine development capability?
Development or manufacture?
No, sorry, manufacture.
Both
actually, but definitely manufacturing.
Well, everybody was pretty scared when Chiron's UK facility went down, happened to be closed.
I remember that.
And that was very scary because there was almost no vaccine capacity on the vaccine. And then in the middle of an epidemic, of the usual seasonal epidemic, everybody had to rejigger their recommendations. So this was always the problem, because something would happen in a manufacturing plant, there wasn't enough vaccine. Then it would all be triaged, even as the CDC started to lower their recommendations. There were times, because of vaccine manufacturing problems, that it all had to be triaged anyway. So everybody was getting all these mixed messages. You know, if I'm at risk, I need to be vaccinated. No, everybody needs to be vaccinated. No, it's not important this season for you to be vaccinated. It's only important for these people to be vaccinated because we don't have enough. And eventually, mostly because of bioterrorism and the pandemic threat, people were really concerned about investing. And the government basically said, we have to invest in U.S.-based vaccine manufacturing. And most of the plants that are actually built are now that are modern vaccine manufacturing plants like that as well.
Yeah, I think Texas A&M just got a couple hundred million dollars to make sure that there was adequate vaccine capacity. Yeah. Yeah.
The economic stuff was really important. I mean, if we happened to be working in a setting where we were making flu vaccine, and the government of Hong Kong, which for development, for economic reasons, if this hub of financial activity was threatened by a pandemic, so that people weren't actually willing to come in to do business, the government of Hong Kong was dramatically concerned about just economic failure as a result of flu vaccine threats. And we're coming to people in the United States to literally build flu vaccine manufacturing capacity
there,
even when it wasn't necessarily needed there, so that people could say, but yeah, there's a little bit of a problem, but look at our nice shiny manufacturing plant that we'll use to make vaccine if there was a problem, because the economic impact in places where pandemic or bad flu intervention was
explore more a distinction between broad-based approaches versus risk-based approaches. So the broad-based would be preferred. Is it because in the risk-based approach there's always some discretion as to who gets it, and would your answer change if it was a very expensive proposition?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the experience with flu has been just that the messages to the public are very, very complicated. So part of the problem was that for flu, because it happens every year, because it changes every year, because the government message about it changes every year, it's a good match, it's a bad match. People don't understand, I don't get flu from the vaccine. You can go and survey all these people and ask tons of intelligent people, about it and say, yeah, I never get that vaccine because last time I got it, I got flu.
But because it's cheap, because the vaccine is cheap to manufacture. Once you have the facility, it's cheap to manufacture. But presumably a risk-based approach would make sense if your resources were limited, you could only manufacture so
much. Well, that's what they do.
And it was prohibitively expensive as well.
Right. Expense wasn't really the problem, but the problem really was supply. And so it was always a big issue that as soon as supply got threatened, then triage happened, and it was all high risk. And the first vaccine recommendations 50 years ago were for the elderly primarily, because that was the highest risk population. And then they gradually moved down to 50, and then they sort of got to kids, and then they sort of picked up the middle group just very recently. I mean, that was only in the last 5 years or something, but there was a universal recommendation. So if you were healthy and in the middle, you were only vaccinated after everybody else was vaccinated.
But so people don't want to be vaccinated, which is the other side of the coin, right?
I'm a free rider. Actually, from an individual perspective, it is the dominant strategy is not to get vaccinated, as long as everybody else is. Economics sometimes breaks down. Okay, so shall we do the case? Can I call on you to do this? Can you do, can you present this case?
This one?
The conflict?
Yes. So, this is a case for the non-executive of the decision to form the clinical work in the revolution. The revolutionary field hospital in Cairo, and when 2011 digital revolution occurred. And then there, I think there are two main focus for researchers to conduct this research. The first one is to know that the happening or the experiment brought by civil revolution in the medical field. And then second one is to know how critical situation influence the physician's action or the decision. And then for me, the two ethical issues in this research are whether there are any benefit or justice of this research itself, and then whether the participant's autonomy or the confidentiality are protected enough to minimize individual.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
I think for me that there are no benefits to conduct this.
No. Wait, we have a bunch of heads shaking. No benefit to doing this?
I don't know if the risks and the benefits really balance out. Yeah.
It's investigative journalism, right?
Right.
Yeah. The ethics of journalism.
Evidence for bringing, potential charges.
Well, wait a minute. These are people with.
What? Not having people over to the government.
We don't know who the researchers are, and it has to be approved by the government.
Right.
So.
And they don't speak about protections. Like, can the government seize their data?
They're in a context of censorship.
But these, so the 30 people have basically been sampled from people who have kind of been out there.
My sense of reading this was people already know what their opinion is. They're just trying to get a little bit more details to buy a sample to begin with. The question really is how systematic or systemic is this problem if you go to just 30 people that are, have already said, look, there's been a problem, that's the answer you're going to get. Mm-hmm. Right? So is that how scientific? That's why I was saying it's investigative journalism. It's important to uncover that, but what's the real question?
So what's the difference between research and investigative journalism?
Actually, that was the question I was asking myself, whether this lady, I was asking whether this is the research, because if the research, what is the request, this is question from here. But already the information are there, and they are just going to interrogate people who already have said this and this happened.
I guess I'm somewhat disturbed that you don't think there's a research question here. If you were basically looking to kind of say, how did these people do this? What motivated them? What resources, access to resources, did they have? What were the things that made it easy for them to do? What were their impediments? Where did they get their supplies?
I'm sorry, there were two questions that were sort of raised in this.
And then there's
the first
political
one is what you're dealing with. The second one,
the political.
Right.
So what price did they pay? But you can still, it gets to confidentiality. If you think about the risks and separate the risks from why do this research, is that important to know? What are the risks that these people took? And it's a biased sample to the extent, it's biased potentially, but to the extent that you've got 30 people, you're sampling from people who've been out there and you're going to snowball with maybe people who weren't out there. And you can guarantee that you're going to keep their confidences, I suppose, depending on where you meet them and stuff like that. And you have to make sure that you're doing that. And it is a risk, probably. Given that the military is still in control. But who's
research? It did pose a qualitative research question. As qualitative research kind of gets done. But it was still very poorly conceptualized. First of all, I couldn't understand exactly what they were doing or how they were getting the people to interview besides sort of looking through YouTube and finding people that had already expressed their opinion before they started to do it. And then, I don't know, the benefit is sort of marginal to me. I mean, sure, I understand a little bit more about medical neutrality or something, but at what risk? And I couldn't tell whether the setting was more of the acute side of the setting, or, you know, when things were really happening, but mm-hmm. still were happening, or was it later after?
I think it's later.
Yeah, I couldn't tell.
And I love that line when they said they've chose people that know how to speak the truth safely and when yeah.
right.
and what to say. I love that. What is that?
So, yeah. I point me out to a person like that.
Yeah, it was just, I thought, well, my main issues were obviously confidentiality. With I don't think they outlined it well enough how they were going to protect it. Could the government or the military leak, you know, legally, or I know things up in the air, say you have to give me your data. You know, there's no certificate of confidentiality that they can get over there. So, you know.
So you eat it.
I mean, I don't know. It just wasn't enough information for me. I think it was the SIOMS 18 that, you know, they need to spell out all the risks, and I don't think they did, because they're like, oh, they know how to take care of themselves. They were already on YouTube, so.
Presumably they're going to be talking about incidents that happened to their military personnel who might have been involved, or government officials,
right.
or hospital administrators, or patients themselves. So there might even be the confidentiality of the people that they're talking about. I don't know how large this place is, if it all happened in 3 or 4 different spots. Maybe people can figure out who they're talking about.
Sure.
The other problem
right.
was I don't think they ever identified who was doing the research.
Well, you mean whether or not this researcher, him or herself, and or staff?
No, who they were. I mean, were they from some university someplace? Were they part of the government? Were they part of the press? Were they part? I mean, who was
Egyptian?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, who is
it? I would assume it's university people.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I assumed, too.
I also thought, as far as confidentiality, that they were being attacked pretty indiscriminately, weren't they? No one was looking at specific doctors to attack. So how can they really...
We don't necessarily know that, actually.
Right. It didn't seem to suggest that they were attacking specific certain people. They just were attacking the street clinics.
Possibly.
So if there's a recounting of anything that went on over there,
they're just going to attack the street clinics.
They already are. Mm-hmm. Possibly. If they tell the story, they know where it's coming from, so they're just going to attack the street.
Anybody else?
For me, I was thinking probably they were sure that these people are protected, because I think this study is being done after the conflict. It was paused. And if it was still during Mubarak's leadership, I think it was very dangerous, because if going to interview these people, it means you expose them to the government. But the government, which they were against too, is now overthrown. It means this is a new leadership.
But it still has a long, long way to go.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the same military that kind of like disbanded the parliament, right?
Yeah, we can say there's the same military, but here the different order. Formerly they are receiving order from the president, but now they are not receiving the same order, a different leadership.
Let me ask you, so let's say there's a civilian government, and let's say the military has really backed off, you know, it's a civilian government. What about those doctors who actually were either forced to or felt it their patriotic duty to hand over, you know, rebels or whoever? Because it's really those, even though I might morally oppose those people, I am worried about their safety. But these sorts of
physicians. Yeah, but is it from the research? I mean, is it the research that puts them at risk, or is it the fact that they did that?
Hmm. The fact that they did that put them at risk of their own volition. If the researcher's involvement brings that more to light, I don't necessarily see the role of research as functioning as an evidence gathering mechanism. There are other ways to do that.
Yeah, but it was, well, I mean, people, there could be anecdote out there on the street, and it's like, you know, you could have some investigative reporters who kind of go out and go, oh, this doctor kind of turned in these 10 people and stuff, and they all hung, and kind of like, but the funny thing is I think that's the difference between investigative reporting and research. I mean, research actually takes this confidentiality really importantly, right?
Exactly right.
And it's actually going to protect people, whereas reporters are like, holy Christmas. I don't want to slight anybody, any reporters here? Any journalists?
Well, reporters protect their sources sometimes.
Sometimes, but the thing is that they're not going to do it. What's the difference? So what's the difference? Let me ask that.
See, so I took a little bit of the opposite perspective. I thought that actually from an investigative journalism perspective, they're under a personal obligation to not disclose their sources.
Right. But sometimes, well, say the researchers too. Why is that different?
But research is done within this context of this sort of broader, you know, perspective of sort of protection checks and balances, so on and so forth. It
exactly, it's pressure, so almost
right. Exactly. So
couldn't hear that.
Yeah, they're more exogenous pressures, whereas I guess in investigative journalism, a lot of that integrity is self-imposed, or I guess you're risking professional setbacks.
Well, let's be fair here. So you know, there have been cases.
What's the difference then between an investigative journalist and a scientist in this setting, where the IRB is useless? You know,
you're
collecting anecdotes, you're writing them down, and there's no checks and balances on it. So,
you don't think this is systematic? You don't think this is systematic enough?
Well, certainly not.
At the level of a documentary, perhaps, yes.
Yeah. So, see, in the interview, a qualitative researcher would say, look, if I have a good instrument and my sample isn't totally biased, it's basically, you know, I'm using snowball sampling, I'm kind of sampling doctors, they know other doctors who are participating in this, I'm going to go out and get a survey sample of about 30, and the sample 30 is not representative, but it's kind of a good, it will give me good insight into what kind of like the variety of practices and why doctors were out there. So 30 is a good number for doing this kind of qualitative research, because it basically makes sure it's enough to give me power to see themes that might emerge. Pardon?
They're not randomly selected.
They're not. So then the qualitative research because it's going so deep, it's actually getting at the core reasons and the differences at a very low level. So instead of just kind of like measuring something at a high level with a survey, you're actually going really deep. And that brings out all the depth and the reasons why people do different things and their different observations. And the coding basically says then, by coding into the data that deeply, you wind up with themes that you can then look at more quantitatively later. But it gives you much, much more... I'm not doing a good job justifying this.
No, I understand exactly where you're going. I'm just sort of saying your conclusions are still going to be based upon your sample. If you go after the YouTube people, no matter how good your database is.
Well, you can snowball sample. You can snowball sample from them, right? They know who the doctors were that did other things. I mean, at the end of the day, any doctors who are really worried about it aren't going to talk to you, right? And that's inherent in the thing. But that's inherent in any kind of talking to the humans.
But if their theory is that there's increased, you know, they're going to find corruption, what are they going to do with that?
Well, the funny thing is, I mean, they're going to question, I mean, is it, I don't know if you want to, I mean, some people would like this data, others wouldn't like the data. You know, yes, there's risk in the data itself, but this is more systematic than any reporter would go after, I think. Reporters might dig this deeply, but they're not going to do it as systematically, and they just don't have the methodological skills. And the questions might be troubling, although they might be also valuable. I mean, if there was a kind of an elected government in place now, it's like, well, what really happened then?
But that's the job of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. That's the job of others, or sort of. I'm not sure.
But how are they going to do it? They're going to call people in and put them on the stand? It's like, wow, we're going
to
get the truth there.
If it's beneficial for society in order to move on from this event to find out what happened, what I find troubling is that they will find answers that most of us, most people, will not like. And then who's going to protect these people?
It's also a different question. I mean, in some sense, it's a different question. I agree that, you know, just saying, well, they can protect themselves, that's probably not adequate. You have to kind of make sure you're meeting them with them in a way that, you know, and you're contacting with them, and you kind of like make sure that their identities are like totally separated from their responses, which you can do by codes.
But
and you
what
can
if
do.
They said the doctors who may have done something really bad would not volunteer, but what about the doctors who volunteer and name names, you know, name names of colleagues?
Mm-hmm.
And
so
say, what, you know, but, I know, you know, Dr. So-and-so, like, handed over a young woman to the military police, I saw that.
So what's your, as I mean, you're not the investigative journalist.
No.
So you're not going after the dirt, what you're trying to say. I mean, you're just basically trying to characterize the events. And this is, you know, it was reported that, you know, some people did this. I mean, you're basically trying to understand what went on, what people were experiencing, what they're exposed to. And you really don't go beyond that. I mean, you never know, researcher is going to out the person and go, oh my God, I'm totally going to turn
I
you in.
I don't know who the researchers are in this setting, so I don't know the answer to that question,
That's fair.
It could be someone who was, you know, a university professor or a grad student who were involved in the whole.
That's fair, too.
I mean, I have less problem with it. I mean, I'm not a qualitative researcher, so I have a harder time understanding exactly what the outcome is going to be, but how it was conceptualized and how it was described varied from all of these questions about experiences to the question of this medical neutrality thing, which seems central to whatever they were talking about. I couldn't figure out what they were actually trying to get at. I mean, were they trying to get at experiential sort of stuff? What was it like to live in that circumstance so that maybe you could intervene with assistance programs or, you know, intervention or something? I mean, all that would be potentially reasonable, but it just sort of was all over the place about what they were trying to do, and I just couldn't figure out whether they would actually get to what they were trying to do.
Well, in some sense, I took away from it that they were trying to understand whether or not the state, you know, the state was actually actively intervening to prevent people who were injured from being treated because they were protesters, in part. Right? And I mean, the funny thing is that from a medical perspective, you're supposed to treat all comers. I mean, even military doctors treat all comers. And, you know, it's like the enemy is brought into your mash and you kind of like treat them. I don't know if we ship them off to Germany if they're missing a limb, but. So I thought that was kind of an interesting question. And from the state's perspective, it's like, was the state sanctioning this? I mean, would the state want that to happen to their citizens? Maybe they don't care. Maybe that was, maybe was it a state policy, or was it something that soldiers were doing on the ground? You know, hooligans were just kind of like doing it. I mean, what do we know? And what don't
that sentence about benefits to society, that the society might benefit from the confirmation of intelligence repercussions taken against citizens. That totally threw me. I was going along with this research.
Yeah, yeah, it was pretty.
Is this a witch hunt?
Well, the funny thing is that, you know, it starts. It's funny because they had the two things.
One, it's witch hunts done in the research context. You know, call it a witch hunt and go for it.
Well, one is, you know, the thing is that they did. They had this kind of like benign. How did you set these up? And access to resources, blah blah blah. And then this other thing is like underneath it all. It's like, what was the state doing to screw you up in here? And kind of like, it's almost like they had an agenda, and which I guess that happens.
And the other issue is, unfortunately, the reality on the ground. My understanding, Egypt is many people will actually transition over from pre-Arab Spring to post-Arab Spring because they're actually the ones who know how to run the country. Mm-hmm. So there is the potential of opening up a whole host of forums. Not that I'm opposed to that, it's just that maybe it's too early to open up that whole host of forums, using research as a way to do it, rather than some other citizens forum, some other forum to do it, some other legal forum, perhaps.
Sure.
Okay, so we can actually continue this conversation post pizza. I'm going to turn this off. Bye.